Our theme for January has been interdependence, and today we're talking about intergenerational caring. So today we're going to reflect on how the generations connected to create the Grannies for Grannies and what we could learn from their successes. How do we enhance our care for each other and our elders, children, and friends? So what systems do we have in place to protect the vulnerable in our society? So we'll turn the proceedings over to Carol Porter, who's going to lead this today.
Thank you. Someone once said to me when I was doing or had just done a presentation, "Well, Carol, we never know what to expect that you're going to do." Now, in keeping with my reputation for unpredictability, and something much deeper than that, I'm going to ask you to join me in something. I've always said, after seeing this on a couple of occasions, that when I go and they walk what's ever left of me out of here, all I want is somebody to say, "She did her best," and a round of applause from the congregation. So I'm going to ask you to join me as I say, "Congratulations, Thelma, on a life lived." So, where are you, Jamie, Hillary? Don't forget, that's what I want. Now, two Sundays ago, we met the soccer grannies of South Africa, Limpopo, South Africa. And the title of everything related to them is Alive and Kicking. And of course, they are kicking the soccer ball, but they are certainly alive. Just to remind us, for those of you who weren't here as well, women from ages 50 to 84, and most have experienced abuse, poverty, and trauma. The first woman we saw, if you remember, said they rape, they steal, they break the house, and sometimes they kill. "But when I play soccer, I am strong. I feel no pain." The pain is gone. And that pain is both physical and emotional. And from that presentation, we drew a number of conclusions about the positive benefits of physical exercise and socialization for older people. In fact, social isolation is possibly the most prevalent issue that confronts older people today, and not just older people. It can be any generation can experience social isolation. Do you recall last week Great Britain created a new ministerial position? The Minister of Loneliness. And at first when I heard this, I thought, this is on CBC, of course, and I thought, oh yeah, this is that. But it isn't. It's real. And in fact, Tracy Crouch, who is now the Minister of Loneliness, will be tasked with implementing the recommendations of the Joe Cox Commission on Loneliness. Joe Cox is a name you will remember. She was the British MP who was murdered in June of 2016. She was shot and stabbed multiple times by a 52-year-old man. This is the results of her commission, and I suppose in a way it's a tribute to Joe Cox. Then last Sunday, we met Rose. Now, Rose isn't here today, but her companion is. You will remember Jerry, and you'll get to talk to Jerry in just a few minutes. Rose was a 75-year-old widow. Ooh, does this ever sound familiar to me? I think this is why they asked me to be the facilitator. Now living with her only son, Stanley, and darned if I can remember his wife's name. Remember Louise? She's Louise for now, because there's no Louises here. And three grandchildren. Now, is there anyone here who wasn't here last week? Okay, well, we're just going to get all on the same page very quickly. You didn't get a chance to meet Rose. Rose was really worth meeting. Rose, and this was a role play, of course, but Rose has experienced financial loss. Her son has taken all her savings to build an addition onto his house. Her pension checks for room and board, even though she does all the cooking, cleaning, and laundry. She is emotionally abused, even to the point of her grandson advising her, "Grandma, stop feeling sorry for yourself," and in many, many other ways. There was the possible beginning of physical abuse as well, and Jerry noted that for us, when her daughter-in-law pushed her aside in the kitchen, leaving her with soreness and bruising on her arm. Rose is socially isolated, with no one to talk to about her situation and no way to go out on her own. Now, we had a lively question and answer, and people were left with lots of questions they wanted answered. And I asked Jerry to come back today to be with us just as a resource for some of those unanswered questions. And we will be looking at these two questions that are noted in your order of service. How do we enhance our care for each other, and what systems do we have in place? So I'm sure that all of this will overlap, so we'll partly be answering those questions as we talk with Jerry again. And if not, we will pick up on them. And Leanne will also have some things to share with us from a legal perspective. So I'm going to wait for a little bit and then ask you to contribute, Leanne. Leanne, for those of you who don't know, and those of you who do, is a lawyer. So she has access to legal information for us. So having said that, and I promised I wasn't going to talk very long, because what's important now is that we speak together. And to that end, I kind of asked the few people who sit on that side to join the middle or the other side. And Jim, will you be scampering up and down with the mic? And I will invite Jerry, if she will, to come up here, and any questions or answers, questions you want answered, or to talk about relating to last week that didn't get finished then. So, who would like to ask a question first or make a comment? Okay. Jane, and then...
George is closest here, so...
George. I just have a question, but I don't have an answer. I'm looking at myself, of course, and my future, and my wife and I live in Regina. We have two sons who we raised in various places, but mainly here, and they've moved to Ontario for the opportunities of their job. When I grew up in Churchbridge, Saskatchewan, on a farm, and my mother stayed there until... she was having trouble living alone, and came. We brought her into Regina. When we brought her in, we tore her out of she said, "Put me in a home." So we brought her to one of these places in Regina, and she was pretty happy there, but she was torn out of her environment in Churchbridge, and all her friends and many of them she never saw again. And my wife wants to move to Ontario, where our kids are, but I don't know anybody there. And I have lots of friends here. You know, should I move? I'm just looking at the future. We're gonna be alone, and so there's this tug between the family where I think often the kids move because of job, and then the parents are left behind to decide about their social environment versus family.
And it is a tough decision. I went through a process with my mother, who was in need finally of a deeper level of care than where she was staying. And it was in Brandon, Manitoba, and I was on the road constantly sort of trying to deal with a crisis in Manitoba. And it was obvious that the choice was between a little deeper level of care or coming to live with us. So after lots of consternation and so on, we chose to have my mother come and live with us, and she lived with us for the last 2.5 years of her life. And it was difficult. It was difficult that she was away from the province that she'd grown up in, her friends who were left, her whole context, and she had us. And that was it. Now that I'm at this stage in my life, I don't have any family except my son and grandchildren here at the moment. And I'm also looking at, what do I do now? How do I build contacts, et cetera? So it's a tough decision. And, you know, I commiserate with your decisions around what do I do now. I think it's important. I recently met Marina, who is an inspiration to me. She has come recently, as all of you know, probably more so than I, from Ottawa, and she's relocated here because of proximity to family, leaving behind friends and other family members. So she's an inspiration to me. I think it's about doing the best in terms of making your decision, but being pretty clear that when you do, you need to rebuild your family, in a sense, your family of friends. And as we get older, I think that gets more difficult, but not impossible. I see Marina, who has a zillion friends already, and fits in beautifully into her newfound community. So good luck with your decision. I'm not sure what the answer is to that one.
Okay. No. Jane? Okay. I'll zip around here.
And I hope you don't think that was a cop-out of an answer.
Thanks. I'm wondering if you might comment about siblings. There were no siblings for the lady in the story previously. She didn't have siblings, and it seemed that there were no other children in the community. Sometimes that can be a good thing, and sometimes not. Can you comment about that? Do you need more?
No, I think it is difficult when there are some siblings to consult with, and it's difficult when there aren't. When my sister lived in Ottawa and I lived here and my mother was in between, there was lots of discussion about what was the right thing to do next. When my sister passed away and it was just me, it was really tough because the decision was mine. I guess siblings are depending on the relationship between siblings and between parents. Can be very supportive, can be very loving, can also not be that way. So I guess I have two boys, and one is far away and one is close in proximity. And I rely on both of them, I guess, in terms of talking things over, being part of the whole process. And so far, so good. So I'm not quite sure how to answer that question either, because I know that there are lots of disagreements about what happens next and lots of struggles around that piece. For the parent, I think it's really important that you make your wishes known when you can and have your ducks in a row and make sure your legal stuff is taken care of, your health directive is up to date and says explicitly what you want done. I think it really helps those who are left when a parent dies. And I think for most of us, as long as I'm able, I want to be in full control in terms of my decisions, where I go, where I live, how I spend my money, all of that stuff. I want to be in full control, but I also know that there may be a time when I'm not able to make those decisions, and I better have it in black and white, and I better have talked to a good lawyer and have it solidly in black and white.
Yes.
Before I pass the mic along, I was just going to tell you a story of a friend of mine who has an older friend who seemed like she was being railroaded to a certain extent by her family. They were implying that, oh, she's having these mini strokes and they don't trust her driving and they don't trust her judgment with regard to her money, of which she had some. And my friend was able to advocate for her with a doctor that was also suspicious of the direction that things were headed in, and this sort of thing was headed off at the pass, and now she's back in her home with her independence and her car, doing what she wants when she wants.
Wonderful. And I think that really speaks to two things: good friends and people that you trust at that level, and a physician or somebody in your world, like a physician, who can in fact advocate on your behalf. If I wanted to talk about abuse in my family, one of the first places I would go would be to talk to my physician. I would also talk to my friends about that if I had the ability to do so. So you've struck two chords in terms of what's really important. And I think as far as our community is concerned, that our friends will often pick up much more quickly than anybody when things are out of whack. And I think, social group, congregation that's close can play a really important role in terms of helping people to stay safe. Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that success story.
Hi. About three years ago, my father died in a nursing home in Calgary, and I had gone back and forth for many years because first my mother died, then my brother died, and so on. And my father always said no, he didn't want to move out of Alberta because he didn't want to leave his Unitarian friends behind. And even though they only visited every couple of months, maybe, that was enough for him to stay tied. You know, he'd been there since 1950. He wasn't interested in moving. But as he aged, and there weren't so many friends visiting, and he started to wonder if he had made the right choice. I know I did, but when I look at it, we're so, in our culture, our WASP culture, I'm going to say, because some of us are from a Catholic background, but most of us are from Protestant and Anglo-Saxon, we value independence pretty highly. We don't, when children are being looked after by their grandparents, we say, well, what's wrong with those parents? But in other cultures, I see all the time that multi-generational picture is always there. The grandparents may look after the children while the parents go to work, or they share the job, they live together. And so I this isn't really a question, it's just an observation. Sometimes I think we ought to value independence a lot less.
Hi, I'm Marina. I had the example of my parents who moved from Toronto to Ottawa when they were in their mid-80s. Because my father was an Anglican minister, and he certainly watched people age with all of those implications. And I think he really hoped he was going to live long enough that he would need help, because he really wanted to live long, and he did, to 101. So I think that was his motivation. And I concluded from that, and I was very grateful, because when I hear the stories of people traveling back and forth to manage their aged parents' wellness, my heart goes out to them. It was a very enriching experience for me personally to have them in the city, never mind the physicality of it all. So I had that example, and when they moved to Ottawa, they engaged in a faith community, and that's where they started. And that was one of the first things I did coming here. I have the heart of a Buddhist / Unitarian. So it wasn't difficult, and of course it was probably the best decision, one of the best decisions of my life. I couldn't be doing what I'm doing without all of you. So it was a plan, and I observed that plan, and I think that's the thing that I conclude, is that we know we're all, if we're lucky, we age, and we definitely know we're going to die. And to have some kind of plan, and you can say, well, you know, plans change. Yes, they do. But I think that gives one a sense of responsibility for self, thereby touching in on that idea of independence. What that plan looks like might be, I'm going to stay here, I don't have family here, but I'm going to have a power of attorney, and I'm going to set it up. But I'm going to take responsibility for not pretending that this life is going to go on forever, and not making other people responsible for that. And I was really grateful to my father, who found it very difficult. He ran a multi-million dollar parish in Toronto, and little by little, as his world got smaller and smaller and smaller, he could have clung on to that ego-driven idea of independence, which he did to a certain extent, but not at my expense. We were a team. Now, the last thing I want to say is that I think there's a gender difference in this that makes it very difficult for men. Women can do lunch. We chat about anything. We can have our children, our relationships, we just talk. That's part of our nurturing gene, I think, and it allows us to share and have input. I do believe it is more difficult for men, and they are perhaps a little bit, their creativity needs to be challenged a little bit more in how they would connect. My father was lucky, he went into a retired clergy association. So that, for him, moving. For me here, it's kind of playing to your strengths. So the faith community, my interest in writing, and then a few other peripheral things like learning to play the ukulele. And now I'll stop. Thank you. Thank you.
Boy, these are tough questions. Like, I thought these would be really simple questions this morning. Interdependence and dependence and independence. Interesting. I think interdependence is a fabulous thing when it works in terms of support over generations. I currently live part-time with my grandchildren and full-time with my son. So I've had the full range of experience in terms of living in an interdependent situation. It's tough. It's hard. But it's also wonderful. And so, well, you struggle to find a way of being loving and caring and supportive, you also struggle with the things that are tough when you have a different perspective, etc. I see myself, while living in interdependent situations, as being a very independent person. I keep the things that I hold dear to myself in a way. I'm very clear that I'm out and doing things. I'm taking classes. I'm being involved in things that interest me. I have friends who I'm quite close with. And I'm determined for as long as I can be to be independent in my choices and decisions while living in an interdependent household. And it's lovely, and I'm less lonely than when I was living as a widow. And when I had my mother living with me, I wouldn't have wanted to have missed that for anything. While we'd always been pretty good pals, I got to know my mother on a very different level, and we just got to be very, very good friends. I learned a lot about her, and I was able to share lots of things about my own life with her. So sometimes we don't have choice about how we have to live or who's close or far away or whether we move or stay. But when we can, I truly believe that we need to take, as Marina said, personal responsibility for our choices and decisions. And I think the tough part comes is when we find ourselves in vulnerable circumstances that we haven't anticipated. And I think for a lot of people that I've talked to over the years in counseling, they find themselves being vulnerable in ways that they never anticipated and are often incredibly ashamed and despondent about circumstances that they find themselves in, where a loving child or a child who appeared to be very loving and supportive somehow changes because of circumstances. And when they're in that circumstance of being emotionally, psychologically, or physically abused, it's a very difficult piece. Then we need to be able to speak out. We need to tell somebody. We need to go to somebody and say, something's not okay. And boy, that's tough. I've seen it with women who are living in abusive relationships, spousal relationships, and also older people. It's a really tough thing to face up to. So for those who are around that person, when you see something that doesn't kind of add up, ask some questions. So, how's it going? What's going on? You seem to be a bit different. Can I come pick you up and take you to church? Can I take you out for lunch? And listen carefully, and hopefully that person would be able to then talk about what's really going on. I'm kind of diverging from the question, but...
I'm going to ask you a question. After the service last week, someone said to me, I didn't hear that her phone was disconnected. How much do you think personal responsibility there is with the abused person to reach out and to take some? And what is it that keeps them from getting on the phone and saying, hey, I want to see that movie. You want to come and pick me up? Even if you're not saying, hey, my son is robbing me blind, you could say, I'd love to go out with you, or whatever.
I think when we're in difficult circumstances, we hope that people are going to somehow see it and name it. And sometimes that happens when we have a very close friend and they see something going on that's different. But I think it really does come down to having to say to somebody at some point, whether it's your doc or whether it's your lawyer or your next door neighbor, I'm in trouble. What keeps people from doing that most often is shame and sorrow, because who wants to imagine that somebody in their life is hitting them, stealing their money, taking their property, telling them they're less than? Nobody wants to talk about that. That's one of the toughest, most brutal things, I think, for anybody to name. And so that's what makes it difficult. And so sometimes people are left in distress and die as a result rather than speak about the truth, to admit what's going on. That's the basic part of it.
Yeah, I realize we probably only have a couple of minutes left. Thank you, Jerry, for coming. I was thinking when we were talking about whether people as they grow older should move to where their kids are or not, and it has struck me that there's a matter of timing involved. And I was just wondering what your observations are on that. Like people in the end maybe do need to be closer, because I've seen so many of my friends that are out of town about half time because they have parents that are needing them, but they can't run their own life because they're not here. And then, but their parents really want to be with, well, where they've always been. Anyway, is there a time sort of when people would be good to just pick up and go?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, having just looking at my own experience with my parents, first of all, my father had ill health and required, and both my mother and father needed help through that piece. My sister was in Ottawa, and I was closest. So I was on the road almost constantly and falling asleep at the wheel and things like that. I mean, I was working full-time, had a family, falling asleep at the wheel. I almost killed myself on one trip and finally had to say, Mom, you know, what shall we do here? Here are the options. We explored all of the options. I also had been fortunate that I had a niece who had helped my mother quite a bit and did the picking, dropping, taking to doctors, you know, all of those things, who finally said, I can't do it anymore. I'm older, I can't do it. My own health is not okay. So we had to look at options. And of course, my mother did not want to move, did not want to change. And I could fully understand that. But finally had to say, these are the two options. And it's up to you. And I left her to make that decision, and it took a number of months before she made the decision. It was tough. But for people to make decisions ahead of time, gosh, I don't know how you can read into the future, you know? I'm sort of in a process like that right now, in a way. While I have my son here and grandchildren, I also have a son in New York, and who I never see. And I like to be closer. Well, I'm not going to New York. But perhaps there are places that might be closer. So I kind of look at those things. I think, well, proactively, my health is pretty good. I could do this, that, and the other thing. And then reality hits, and it's kind of like, well, I think maybe for right now. So I don't know how to answer that question except on a very personal level, and it is tough. I don't know how people continue to do that. As I get older, if I were required to do that kind of care for my parents at a distance, I couldn't. I don't think I'd be just schwacked. I couldn't do it. Couldn't do that piece. Schwacked. I'm not sure what that is.
Thank you. Jerry will be here. We negotiated an extra 10 minutes last week, right? Because we started a little bit later. Okay. Let's look at our questions and see where we got to in our discussion so far. How do we enhance our care for each other and our elders, children, and friends? Stanley and Louise. Stanley is a very bad man. He has been probably taken over by greed, but he's also a member of the sandwich generation, which many of you either are or have been, where you're caring for your children and you're caring for your parents. And that isn't an easy role. Doesn't excuse the maltreatment that a lot of people hand out to either their children or their... Richard, you went for a lot of years caring for your son, didn't you? And it took over your life. Yeah.
So it isn't just our elders. We were talking about intergenerational. In fact, when I saw that first, the person I wanted to invite to present with me was Petra. Petra is 13 years old, and I thought she might give a new dimension to the subject of care, talking about how young people take care of older people, as well as how older people take care of children. So it is something to think about there. I know when I had a four-year-old son, we were living in a house, and the neighbors were in their 80s. I shoveled their walks, but so did he. He had his little shovel out, and I told him it was our job. They didn't have family. I said, it is our job to look after these people. And I think he turned out okay. Doesn't have to shovel snow anymore because he lives in Ireland, but I'm sure he's found other ways to help people out. Now, so how do we? Anybody like to comment on that? How do we enhance our care for each other and other folk? Have you said what you wanted to say already on that? So we know some ways. We learned some ways from last week and this week. Now, I don't want to leave us without looking at what systems do we have in place to protect the vulnerable in our society. And I would ask Leanne if you would comment on that and give us your handout. Would you like to come up? Or, yeah, whatever. Here, I'm going to meet you in the middle.
Okay. Thanks, Carol. So I wanted to start with my disclaimer that, you know, anything I say is, of course, just in my personal capacity. And that what I have to share is some information, not advice. I found, as I think everyone else did, the presentation last week to be really interesting and very important topic raised, and it gave me a lot to think about and reflect on this week. One of the questions that was asked at the end of the presentation last week, I heard and remember the question as being, if a person could make an anonymous complaint. And I heard the answer as suggesting that you needed permission of the individual who was the victim of abuse to make a complaint on their behalf. And that gave me pause, and it didn't sound right to me. And when Carol and I were discussing it after, I volunteered to try and, you know, follow up on that a bit this week, which I've tried to do. So I'm not going to comment on the whether or not an agency will take an anonymous complaint, because I suspect that's going to vary from organization to organization. I would encourage everybody to try. If you have something that you think needs to be reported and a complaint that needs to be made, go ahead and try. If you think you need to try and do it anonymously, see if they'll take an anonymous complaint. I appreciate what I think is the respectful approach of starting with the person that you think is the victim and hearing their thoughts and hearing their wishes on this. And I read some of the literature that was available last week after the presentation, and it certainly encouraged people to do that, and that seemed to make good sense. But I would also encourage people not to just stop if you have a sincere concern, and even if you don't have the expected or suspected victim's permission. So something I got this week, I went to a website for PLEA. It's called the Public Legal Education Association for Saskatchewan. You may or may not be familiar with it. And they have a lot of resources on their website that are publicly available. They have lawyers on staff. I would just say it's a very reputable organization. Yes. So I, oh, the whole package, yes. So I got this, I got them to send me for today a whole bunch of these brochures on abuse of older adults. So it's Saskatchewan information, and in the last couple of pages, it tells you specifically where you could go. Like, if you think it's financial abuse, you know, you can go to the Public Guardian and Trustee's office. If you think it's fraud, you can go to the Consumer Protection Division. If you think it's a doctor being abusive, if you think it's a personal care home staff person being abusive. So it gives very specific resources for where to go, and then some general ones as well, like clergy, social worker, elder, ethnic community. It encourages you to talk to the bank manager if you suspect financial abuse and you know where the person banks. So I wanted to share that because I think it's useful Saskatchewan information.
In terms of the question, and I think was the person who answered that question. I think what's always underlying that piece is you have to be pretty careful when somebody has shared with you what's happening in their life that you don't put them in increased danger. And yeah, there are a number of places you can go. There are a number of people that you can talk to. I guess our perspective from working with people who are victims of abuse is that you would support them in terms of making that report. That you wouldn't necessarily go on your own volition to say, I think that there's something wrong. Now, you could certainly do that to get advice as to what the Sam Hill do I do next, right? But I think the underlying piece for me always is that you don't want to put that person in increased danger. And so you need to be pretty careful about your next step. I think that was my only thing to add.
Thank you. I guess we used up our extra 10 minutes. As we close off this discussion, though, and I can tell that everyone has a personal response to what we've talked about here, and probably a personal experience. This is one area where we all have experienced something that was not to us necessarily, but to others. Now, I have a son who lives in Ireland. He's my only child. And I think sometimes that's a mixed blessing. Not that he's an only child, but that we are distant from each other in some ways, because every time I make up my mind to move to Ireland, I go over there and say, where are my friends? But what am I going to do? Where's the Unitarian congregation? Where's the learning center? How do I drive on the other side of the road, you know? And it is, it's difficult. But in closing, I would like to draw your attention back to something that we look at every week and sometimes forget, which is our principles. And I think that this issue speaks very well to the inherent worth and dignity of every person. No matter what their age, no matter what their physical capacity or whatever, the worth and dignity. Justice, equity, and compassion. Compassion in how we relate to each other and acceptance of one another. I think this is very much in line with our principles, and I thank you for the opportunity to more or less get you talking further on this issue. And thank you again to Jerry. And thank you to Leanne.
Thanks also to Carol for leading this presentation today.